Before we get started today, I wanted to thank a great sponsor for Business Second Opinion podcast that is one of my favorite deep business ideas, using ancient wisdom coupled with modern innovation to give vitalizing beverages you can be proud of. Their rallying cry is, "We are Rebel, a band of revolutionaries for the greater good." They are modern day botanical treasure hunters grounded in ancient herbal wisdom, identifying and gathering the very best the plant queendom has to offer. They curate diverse, ethically sourced, whole roots, extracts, berries, and barks and leaves into delicious beverages with vibrant flavors. Through the art of food and taste, they welcome you to their tribe and their world of plants, to the world of Rebel. We are so proud to be associated with them. Welcome to Business Second Opinion. This is the podcast that digs deep to answer questions about business and business practice you may not know you need to be asking, but we believe you should be asking for the benefit of your understanding and your business's ethics and practice. In the process of answering them, we give you a second opinion, usually a contrarian opinion, but that's well-tested and proven to give the outcomes you really want without the nasty side effects. We make our thinking explicit so you can apply it to other topics, educating all around. I'm Zach Swartout, and with me as always is Carol Sanford, our in-house positive contrarian, responding to big and hard questions with a radically different take. Hey, Carol.
Hello.
So what are we looking at today?
Well, there's something I notice over and over again, not only as I read books that are out there, but the Harvard Business Review articles. Of course, most people are writing because they've been examining something in more depth and they want to call attention to what they think is a better way. So it goes something like this. Some thinking person begins to see the flaws in what we have been calling a best practice. And something is long held, maybe even as a gold standard on a subject or a situation. And they may even do a really decent job pointing out the problem with this practice, either in terms of, well, it's not working as promised, or, wow, it may be working, but it's causing more problems than it cures. So an example of that is Daniel Pink, the social scientist and author, got religion some time back, used a lot of research, but about incentives and rewards, and wrote a book called Drive. It had tons of evidence about how incentives work only in very limited ways, usually the things that are very short term, but not so well on big and important things that we really need to manage. However, when he suggested something as an alternative, very little of the same rigor and examination was expended that he used to tear down incentives and rewards. He recommended an alternative, looking at what he considered was a more up-to-date understanding of how motivation works. And what he recommended was, of all things, feedback, 360 and all others in every form. So there's very little analysis of why this would be better than incentives and rewards, although I thought he did some good work on showing the research and the thinking about why the other didn't work. But he was likely thinking, wow, you can't just do this tearing something apart and leave us with the problem. You can't just leave people hang out to dry when you say you can't use incentives and rewards anymore. You got to give something as a substitute. So you say, stop this, now start that.
Okay, right. So it sounds like we're trying to highlight the need for greater rigor when critiquing and giving substitute ideas. In Dan Pink's case, as you're saying, it's feedback for incentives and rewards. I guess now it looks like we're seeing the same pattern play out in an article on the cover of this month's Harvard Business Review called Why Feedback Fails by Marcus Buckingham and Ashley Goodell of Cisco Systems. It looks like they also offer an alternative, but I think we'll get into that in a little bit. We've definitely covered incentives and feedback in the past, to be sure, but today is really about pointing out an underlying problem which hides inside most kind of quote-unquote best practices. It's the idea that proving that one does not work often leads to picking another one out of the basket of best practices, freshening it up a bit, and finding a seemingly less damaging practice to end your article so that you feel like a hero. So what's the alternative to feedback? I assume someone will find another question soon and undermine Buckingham's work and give the next option.
Well, yeah, there's no doubt about that because that's kind of the nature of research and thinking. But how do we stop this cycle of knocking something down, often with research, knocking down this beloved practice and substituting another practice that's later found out to be ineffective? And in this case, I'd say more like it's really incomplete. The problem is not the practice and one practice, the next practice. You can prove all of them will do something, but it's the way of thinking about it that's really the problem. Now, I like this article because it lets us do something different than we have before. It lets us demonstrate some kind of missing discernment that's needed to really examine and replace. So today's podcast is what I would call heeding Einstein's admonition. You know, Einstein said you can't use the same mind or the same thinking to find a better plan. If you use the same mind, it will get us to exactly the same place.
So if I recall correctly, this is definitely one of the most cited, you know, often cited quotes in modern times. Einstein spoke of this concern in over a dozen different citations based on the same kind of essential idea, a wrong level of thinking. I looked it up, and here's one of the most repeated versions. Quote, "The world that we have made as a result of the level of thinking we have done thus far creates problems that we cannot solve from the same level of thinking." So I guess in essence, it's a warning. But how would you know if you were using the same way of thinking? It seems when I ask people how to do this, the most often assumed response is to think outside the box. I heard that one a lot when I was in healthcare. Others say this requires taking a leap of faith or following the path less traveled, or use your imagination. These seem to be cliches which give no guidance, actually, on this idea of new levels of thinking. I would think you have to know the box you're actually in order to do that.
Yeah, that's probably kind of true. And do we even have a way to define what the same level versus different level means? That's what I want to point to. There's a well-tested method, I believe, that I want to suggest for embracing Einstein's admonition. Some of this we actually do as the underpinnings of every episode we do, but it's a skill that people need to develop so that they can question everything if they want to heed what Einstein is suggesting and not just watch a series of authors, social scientists, you know, give us the next idea and then require reframing of it down the line. I particularly think that this Buckingham and Goodell article lets us see the evolution in thinking that can happen if we can use this particular framework I want to suggest, because Buckingham and Goodell do rise to a new level, at least in many ways, not just bringing forward exactly the same way of thinking. So it gives us some guidance about how we could learn to discern before we accept something. So the question is, what is Einstein's intention here? Or at least that's what makes me want to ask. What does he mean to direct us toward? And how do we learn to do this? So there is a plausible interpretation of how it relates to our thinking processes and to regenerative thinking specifically.
I was rereading a few of these right before we started, and most of his emphasis in the various statements is really on thinking, then levels of thinking, and finally, changing our thinking. So Einstein was presumably able to make this shift for himself routinely, that is, literally to change how he was thinking, even though he seems to have been less successful in teaching others what he meant, given that none of this has been passed down to his students. He has no students that reference having received such guidance. So this may be because his work was primarily as a research faculty member rather than a teaching faculty member. Or maybe it was so normal to him that he could not articulate actually how it worked in his own mental processing.
Well, I bet you're right there, because people who actually have an alternative way of thinking can tell that what they come up with is different, but it's very hard to explain it. So that's why I want to explore this path that gives us a way to discern the level of thinking and then apply it to this specific Harvard Business Review cover story on feedback, and particularly, again, how Daniel Pink recommended it and how Buckingham and Goodell say don't go in that direction so we don't end up with these revolving doors and alternatives. Yeah, I tend to agree with you, Zach. When great geniuses, we might call them, can see something different, they know they're seeing something different, but it's very hard for them to describe how they're seeing it. They can see the what, and the person they're disagreeing with is the what. So I want to explore this path that gives us a way to be discerning about the level of thinking that we're at, and then apply it to this article on feedback, the Harvard Business Review one on the cover of March, April 2019, which says why feedback fails. It's common to hear in modern times, not even unusual anymore, to have people talk about a paradigm shift. And I think that's what Einstein is talking about. But then it's like out of the box. You got to know what a paradigm means when you're in one and know how it is you can move through it. So I went back. I mean, I think you already know I studied a little bit with Thomas Kuhn when I was an undergraduate at Berkeley. And it gave a fundamental change to the concepts as the practice of thinking for me. And it gave a set of experiences and practices that caused us to be able to change how we held what was true and a reference for what we mean by the box.
So, Carol, this is a worthy idea, to be sure, but that doesn't answer the question of how do we know if we're actually thinking from a new paradigm? The irony is that when we are in the situation of actually trying to think better, we become victims of our own lack of perspective, I find quite often. We can see the merits of our own point, you know, our own point of view, but we struggle to understand and accept the merits of alternative points of view. And this metaphor of point of view, I think, is apt here because we tend to let our perspective get collapsed down into a single point of what we can see and manage, almost like a pinhole. But I think I may have an idea about how to think about this. So if I'm recalling correctly, in the late 1800s, a British philosopher named Edwin Abbott wrote a witty little book named Flatland to illustrate this problem. In it, the residents of a two-dimensional world struggle with how to imagine a world of three dimensions. Their two-dimensional perspective means that they can only see a sphere as a circle. When they visit a one-dimensional world, the problem actually gets even worse. Residents of a one-dimensional world see everything as points in a string, which often become isolated elements or parts. Abbott vividly illustrates the influence of our perspective and thinking patterns on how we perceive reality. But more importantly than that, actually, he shows that there are different levels of perspective. When we collapse our vision, we actually become unable to see the full range of possibilities that are laying hidden in plain view. To access these possibilities, we need to become able to explore multiple points of view from a level of perspective that sees their potential relatedness. So perhaps learning to work on paradigm shifting and out-of-the-box thinking requires considering the unfolding of life from three to four dimensions, where so much of us are trapped in our current point of view. And this also does not allow us to see what's hidden from our flatland view. I'm often surprised that Einstein did not cite Abbott when calling out the need for a new level of mind. So now, if I take all that and I apply it to your original point, in order to have a different mind at work, we have to move the mind to seeing beyond this kind of flatland view, to seeing it as a dimensional one, a multidimensional one. And paradigms are actually at different levels, not linear as the next anything. So I feel like that's where we're going today. So Carol, how do we do that?
Yeah, so I think that's a beautiful explanation. And I love Abbott's work too as a way of understanding that perspective is affecting us. And I think it's very much what Kuhn is talking about. And I think our authors and their new alternatives often are sensing there's an old paradigm that they're trying to help us get away from, maybe even levels of paradigm, and that people are operating or observing through the language, through the stories. And we can feel that it's outdated, but we don't exactly know how to adopt this new paradigm. So to make it easy to grasp how paradigms show up individually and collectively, I think the framework that I created some time back that we've used provides an encompassing perspective on how to do that. Most people work and have worked in places where choices are being made about managing people and based on one or another prescribed managing systems, that each of these actually come from a different paradigm, which you've heard me describe before. And it offers us a method for being able to see different results that are going to be measured at different levels of thinking.
So this is a frame of reference we've used before. You call the four governing worldviews of modern living machine, behavioral, human potential, and evolved capacity, if I'm remembering correctly. So taken together, they're actually a hierarchy of systems, each giving us a more complete level to view things from, in other words, a perspective. From this idea of flatland to a revolving and evolving spherical worldview, I'm guessing that we're going to find that even though Buckingham and Goodell are disagreeing with Pink and giving us yet another practice, you think they're thinking from the same level. So Carol, help us to pay attention a little bit better so these ideas don't slip by us so often. Can you start by reminding us the way to differentiate between each of these four levels?
Yeah, and I'm not surprised you think that that's where I'm going, because most often people do generate an idea to get rid of one practice from the same mind. But if I think about the feedback article specifically, they actually, and unusually so, did move to another nature paradigm. I think it was still incomplete. And they didn't do what Pink did, which was drop a paradigm. He went from a behavioral back to the machine. And the reason I said they dropped a level is machines have nothing to do with anything alive, where at least behavioral had to do with rats. So let me remind us more what those are so we can look at the No More Feedback article and where it shows up. So when we use machine metaphors, machine paradigm, we're using machine as a metaphor to understand people. So we're saying the human motivation is a clock ticking time out, or a life is, or a computer is the brain. And we make this correlation with humans being like machines in some way. This is actually the source of where the idea of feedback even came from. The machine idea, where you have a machine which could run over, and if it was hot oil or hot water or something, you want to be able to stop that kind of variance. And you put a governor on it that when it gets feedback, it can shut everything down and stop the harm. Now, the problem is it does a similar thing to the mind, where it kind of shuts it down when it gets it. This adaptation to humans as machine happens in the 1960s. And I give a whole bunch of the history on that and how we got into this idea of feedback in my new book, No More Feedback, Cultivating Consciousness at Work. Then the second paradigm up, which evolutionary was about 100 years ago, was where we used research methods, particularly John Watson did, and theories based on the study of rats in mazes to try and understand and manage people based on the idea that humans are mammals, and so we must be the same. Now, these first two paradigms have one thing in common, and we can see this where Pink stepped backwards, as I said, into the machine era, and Buckingham made an error by not letting go of it completely, but moving slightly to a new plane. So what do they have in common? There's a little bit that Buckingham and Pink have in common. They both see the world and people to be managed from an external input. So a machine needs to have oil put into it. Rats need to have food put in the maze. Managers, therefore, need to be there to help people. And the external feedback, whether it's positive or negative, is assumed in both of their paradigms in order to manage and change behavior. For machines, we can set it up so it can be done automatically. But with humans and behavior, you're working on getting compliance through stimulus and response with managers who are intending, I think well-intended, to point people toward a path of achievement and performance for the business, which is, of course, their focus.
So the sense I get is that these two levels are about humans being blind to themselves, which is true, but by lack of development, it sounds like, not by nature. But the belief that I'm a rat or have rat wiring seems to go a bit too far. In most of my life, I find that I'm unable to see myself, to be sure. But in the past couple of years, through practice and reflection, I find I'm more able now to manage my state rather than actually falling victim to it.
Yes, and that's true for all human beings, but we're not developed in that way, as you pointed out. And there are two keys to understanding why you've been able to do this for yourself. The first is that you are not a rat, and that you are not limited by the same working of the brain as a rat. And secondly, you're not fixed. I mean, we just did that in the last episode, fixed versus growth versus development. You know you can change yourself, and the people you've been around knew that. This is actually where the third paradigm comes in, which I call the human potential movement, because it came as a reaction to the behavioral movement. And even if you go look at functional science now and the work that's coming out, you're seeing the work point to humans as unique and distinctive, each and every one, and able to become self-aware. And Buckingham and Goodell demonstrate their grasp of this idea clearly and see it as the shortfall to feedback. You're not seeing individuals as unique, each situation is unique, and that humans can become self-aware. there is some profound work, which I've cited over and over again. Zach, I know you get tired of hearing me talk about it, but it's so important, and more will come like this, where the Harvard Business Brain, Mind, and Education Institute did some research and discovered that treating people generically or as a one of a type does not work. And the book you can find it in is The End of Average by Todd Rose. For those who want to know more, it's researched and articulated and laid to rest in that book, as far as I'm concerned. I've been saying it for 40 years, and I think the reason I cite this book over and over again is because it has strong research. The one step in that direction that is taken on in Buckingham and Goodall's work is this idea of strengths. And of course, Marcus Buckingham created that idea some time back, used the strengths of each individual rather than their problems. But it's still one level down from the idea of the fourth paradigm of evolved capacity, because it's still seeing people as more fixed, but they're strong in some things. And we all know that strengths now come from mostly the experience we have in the situations we're in. They are not innate to us as humans, but it does give us a way to at least acknowledge that this piece of this article in Harvard Business Review is helping us step into the beginning of the human potential movement, not just the behavioral one.
So the human potential worldview is definitely one I know quite a bit about from being in personal development world for a long time. It's about being kind and empathetic and purposeful and mindful and a good human being and good to others, but also seeing a world in which humans can grow. They're not fixed and have to be managed like non-human animals. It's behind the research and book Mindset that we looked at in last episode by Carol Dweck. And I see what you mean about switching from external input being needed to engaging self-awareness being more critical. It seems like Dan Pink didn't actually make this shift. Incentives and rewards are behavioral and draw on external input and believe that humans cannot be self-managing fundamentally. It's all about our reward center. But Pink went to a machine worldview and suggested feedback, which Buckingham and Goodell soundly disrupt. Your book, Carol, No More Feedback, does something similar. It makes clear that even with all the enhancements to feedback methods, they are still always based on erroneous ideas about how humans work, especially as part of a living system.
We've probably gotten that part pretty clear. Let's take it more to look now at what would it mean if Buckingham and Goodell were to go to the fourth level of paradigm we know is existing in the world today. And, you know, eventually things may move beyond that. But the evolved capacity is based on the study of living systems, and it sees humans as nested in these living systems. It also sees nature as nested in these living systems. Humans are not nature. Humans have a role and work to do in this living system. But one more thing. Humans need to develop the capacity we have to do that work. And that work particularly includes being able to make sense of the world beyond our senses. One of the things that the behavioral paradigm did is it got us stuck in that we could only pay attention to what we could count and what we could see. But we actually know that we can see and make sense of a great deal more that our senses can't pick up if we can image things at work and see how they're working. And it can help us actually understand how to help society work and planetary processes work. But we need to be able to think and act from examining the dynamics of living systems. Now, that's a lot of words and a big idea, right? But we know that the way we're taught, well, the way parents are taught to raise their children is not to teach them to see the world and make sense of it, but to teach them the content of what's right and wrong. Don't do this, do this. Here, I'm going to give you a gold star for that. You get the stick and sit in the corner for that. So the child is taught to copy, borrow, and mimic rather than examine. Same thing happens in the school system where knowledge is crammed in and you take a test and you prove you learned what the teacher taught you. So we need to, and that's what the evolved capacity paradigm title means, is we need to intentionally develop the processes that get embedded in these infrastructures where this happens, like schools and businesses. And we have to design ways to really take that on.
So I think I'm following, but can you give me an example of what you mean that's a little bit more concrete?
Yes. For example, in the article, Why Feedback Fails, they talk about a present, past, future exercise, where the present is you have people when they're very upset and challenged say, what's working for you right now? We know that that produces oxytocin. People feel loved. They feel cared about. But again, you'll notice that's somebody outside of you doing it because it doesn't produce the oxytocin if someone isn't helping you do that nearly in the same way. And then they have you go to the past and say, well, what have you done in the past where you've been able to make something work in a situation like that? And then you go to the future and say, now, how can you apply that and bring it forward? So we have this first problem of it's externally determined where it's somebody else manipulating my oxytocin, which does not actually activate the full humanness of, I think we'd call it the frontal lobes taking charge. Instead, it activates a mammalian brain feeling of me belonging, the emotional context, and it quiets down that reptilian brain that's natter, 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 I'm going to be in trouble, this ain't going to work. Now, that's not a bad thing. I mean, my goodness, parents do that with their kids all the time, find a way to distract them. And in some ways, it's a lot about distraction. But it's missing, and this is the second thing, it's missing one of the most important things that we know can make organizations and societies and each human life work better, which is to be able to have critical thinking skills and ability to manage their own personal state when it comes up. We don't need a manager or a boss or a coach or a therapist unless we don't know how to do that for ourselves. So if we want someone to do that for us, that's fine. But we can learn to do it with processes that we call things like self-observing. I can see my state and I say, oh, I notice I'm upset. My goodness, I'm going off a deep end here. And that very process of noticing ourselves separates ourselves in the same way that someone else asking us that question does, except it adds more than oxytocin. It also brings in endorphins, that joy, giving us a sense of, my goodness, I did this, giving a sense of personal power. And then it myelinates, which is how the brain works to get a pattern going over and over again. It myelinates the idea that I don't have to go to someone to understand this. No, I can have this process I do for myself, which is have personal self-observing, be able to set aims for myself. Now, what is this building? This is building something very different than productivity using great supervisors and you teach them all to do this. It's instead activating internal locus of control in me. I actually am in charge of my life. Wow. And the way we learn to do that, and it's part of all of the programs that we run, are giving people frameworks that they can use on their own to bring forward this next level of capability, evolving capacity, my capacity, not someone else evolving it for me, although we do want to create systems where everybody can be involved in that. It allows us to break this challenge and concern, which was the same thing Buckingham is working on, but I do it myself and I can shift to a different level of mind. So let me take a deep breath here and kind of pull this all back together. I think what's missing from their work bringing this into the human potential world and in some ways, all the other things that are similar, therapeutic processes, biochemistry, getting key intentions, but it's the idea of developing capacity to be more able to be self-managing in regard to my own thinking and my own emotional state. That's what this additional paradigm, I started to say new, but this paradigm is ancient. It has existed in many, many cultures for decades, but none of it comes from outside. It doesn't have an expert model. It doesn't have a leader model. It doesn't have a manager over other models. Instead, it has the ability for people to work in organizations this way together to build reflection, evaluation in a way they can see more. They put in rituals of development that people learn to step into and be able to build this capability. Now, this kind of work is very different than what Buckingham and Goodall are pointing to. What they're working on is performance improvement. Get people to function better and perform better. What the evolved capacity paradigm is working on is involving us as human beings, which makes us better citizens, better parents, makes us happier, healthy. Now, it turns out that also works on performance, but the performance is at too low a level. In fact, we know that we can get performance of 35 to 65% revenue growth a year when people are self-managing and have no managers which are doing this evoking of oxytocin for us.
Ah, okay. Okay, so what we really want to be doing here at this level is about helping people to lift their own will to hold a higher aim to evolve the capacity of the systems around them. I think what I'm seeing here in this way of thinking is about building a thinking capacity to see at different levels. Without building this, it's impossible to be able to consider a larger evolutionary impact we can have, but something stops, like external input. But you have to start, it sounds like, with the idea of a larger scope of consideration. I'm saying all that to kind of work through it and try to figure out what starting and stopping might actually look like here, Carol.
That's true. You do have to significantly decrease and pretty much stop other people telling you how you're doing, because we have been addicted for too long and actually entrained the brain to look for the external because we were told we can't see for ourselves. And that's not true. But you also have to give people a larger context. The kind of ideas that have the present, past, future exercise all keeps it very close in, very narrow in how you're looking at. It doesn't put it in terms of the effect on society, democracy, on customers, on Earth. Those kind of questions don't rise. So we have to add a larger scope, stop the external, and bring in the internal capacity building.
Okay, so make sure I'm hearing you correctly here. So to move to the outer two, you actually have to stop external input and stimulation, or it weakens the building of developing inner processing and agency to get better at that processing.
Exactly.
So on and within evolved capacity, there's no mentors or coaches, but actually a sponsor of developmental work design and infrastructure to build these rituals of development, these regularized kind of developmental engagements and connections to the strategic direction of the company and markets in which they're nested, if I'm following correctly.
So I'm so glad you said that, because one of the ways I think that really shifts when you go to the evolved capacity is, see, the organization is building the mind of a CEO in every human being. Everyone is sitting so that they can see and think like the CEO. Now, you wouldn't think of going to a CEO who was in trouble and saying, you know, tell me something good about what's going on right now. Give me three things. Now, look in the past. Where did you handle this before? No, the CEO would manage themselves. So it's possible, although no one thinks this way, because even Buckingham, even though I used to just love everything he did when I was much younger and could see that it was a next step up, it's still incredibly incomplete because it doesn't have this idea of everyone can think for the whole of the business.
If I'm tracking, it's about moving to an evolved capacity worldview where leaders change to fostering work design so people are connected to contributing and assess success with an external view to the business world, which actually has much less internal assessments. So it's not so much about excellence in functional roles, but excellence in customer results and with other stakeholders. So further, to have more space for initiatives of big promises to make a difference at the end of the day, these have to be self-derived based on some their own essence and choosing that in the context of the business strategy. So there's actually less delegation and external evaluation led by an individual based on those big promises. It's actually more about bigger contributing and the bigger contribution you can see possible and working for in meaningful ways to have lives work better. And of course, all this kind of spills over. So there are actually no experts except outcomes from stakeholder initiatives we take on as individuals. Do people really do this, Carol? Can we switch worldviews and build organizations that foster and evolve capacity to work in this way?
That was such a great summary. I think it is really true that you go to the outcomes of stakeholder initiatives. And yes, people do this. I've written books about it, you know, for over 40 years of it happening, but it does take courageous leaders, which is what I look for. I don't look for a company that's ready to do something. I look for a leader, because often they are the ones who suffered in some other old outdated paradigm that had a less sophisticated understanding, and they were all defined by machines and behaviors and where they came from, and it killed their soul. And so when they got in a place to do something about it, they decided to change. And you can see their stories in The Responsible Business, which I did in 2011, The Responsible Entrepreneur, 2014, The Regenerative Business, which was last year, 2017, and No More Feedback, 2018. And by the way, just because of what we're talking about here, the new book, No More Feedback, is one of the 30 toxic practices, which comes from these older paradigms, the machine, the behavioral, and even the human potential movement, and haven't yet moved all the way up to one where we can really get beyond the toxic practices.
Getting back to Daniel Pink for a second. So he went from a toxic practice borrowed from a badly flawed behavioral view, this idea of incentives and rewards from the human rats in a maze kind of idea, even though it was still driving most practices today, to an older and more limiting machine view of feedback. Now, Buckingham and Goodell take his alternative down and show why feedback is so toxic, but not even accomplish actually what it intends. And they step up a level of thinking to human potential for much of their idea, but still drag forward some of the behavioral view. And it's only about humans, not living systems, we are all embedded in and then specific to our role. I'm assuming that you're challenging this alternative as well, right, Carol?
I am. But actually, what I'm really challenging us is to consider the mind we put to work, whether we're consultants or academics or parents or design practices, and we test these practices before we adopt them. And we ask, which mind are we using when we try and upgrade, improve, or create an alternative? I think I'm actually on Einstein's side here. I'm arguing that that is the right warning to really pay attention to the level of mind, but we needed this framework, you know, the idea of that there are levels of paradigm. And I'm offering what I think is a good foundation for making use of this admonition and making it practical. So there's a set of four modern paradigms that I've laid out that I find work really well for me. And I find when I'm engaging with people in companies or institutions that it really does help them see where they are. And it encourages us all who engage in this to be much more rigorous. And before particularly we start advocating or adopting a practice and to see if we're really evolving society and planetary capability, or if we're just throwing out some other thing and using the same practice so that we create the same problem because we use the same mind that we had before. So as always, here we are again, falling into the trap of something better is really the enemy of best. And so I believe if we use these paradigms, we may get beyond that.
Remember, call and tell us about your organization and business practices. 650-265-1193 or 6502-HUMAN. What worldview do you see yourself continuing to fall into? What aspirations do you have and think to think and work differently? Leave us a question maybe to speak about on upcoming podcasts. Let us know what you think of our show and its focus and content. And also thanks to Numi T, one of the courageous ones that continues to question and examine themselves and their ways of working. Carol, what do you think about Numi?
You know what I think of Numi. And I was just in conversation with Areem and Ahmed in this last week where they're really trying to look at what does it mean to take the connection with the supply system they have and connect that directly with those of us who are drinking the tea by looking at the essence of the people who are actually growing tea and looking at the essence of us who are drinking tea. So they're just, to me, an inspiration. Not only do they provide a great product, but anyway, loved them long before I knew the people.
Also, Carol has posted a paper on these paradigms that you can check out at the regenerativeparadigminstitute.com. This has been Business Second Opinion.